Again, my name is Dan Spencer, and this is the second in a series of 5 sessions on the church in Central America. Today we're going to focus on what I call the Church of the Poor in Central America, or the grassroots church, or base Christian communities. It goes by a variety of different names. Just as a brief review, yesterday I tried to lay out a framework for understanding the different dynamics present within the church, primarily the Catholic Church, but we also see similar things in the Protestant churches. And the third one that we focused a lot on is the dynamic within the church that's been emerging in the last 2 decades, particularly since Vatican II, of a liberation trend within the church and some of the dynamics within that. I want to focus more specifically on that and look at a couple of different aspects of it. First, by looking at what some of the roots are, both the theological roots of this new movement within the church and the political roots, the political context that it comes from. And then look more specifically at what is the Church of the Poor and why people are choosing to call it Church of the Poor as a new/old model of the church. Talk a little bit about Christian-based communities or base ecclesial communities, and then how they identify their own identity and mission. I'd like to start, however, just by a short story that I think will illustrate some of the new dynamics that are emerging. If you remember yesterday, for those of you here, we talked about the traditional church in Latin America being one of a very small hierarchy and elite, running the church with a very submissive, dominated mass of people that were not given much role within the church. Theirs was simply to persevere and suffer in this world and hope that they would get their reward in the next. I had a professor when I studied in Costa Rica, a man named Pablo Richard, who is formerly a priest from Chile and forced to leave Chile in 1973 when the Allende government was overthrown. And he now lives in Costa Rica and has left the priesthood and has a family, but he works very much with the base communities throughout Central America. He told a story of one time when he went to Guatemala and was working or visiting some of the very, very young base communities among the Indian villages there. And someone had read a text and he was talking about it, and he asked one elderly Indian man, he said, viejito, a little old, an affectionate term for little old man, viejito, what do you think of this passage? What thoughts do you have? And he looked at the man, and the man began to blush and began to cry. And Pablo Richard was really embarrassed. He didn't know what he had done. And so he kind of softly repeated, what do you think about this passage? And the man looked at him and he said, this is the first time in my whole life anyone has ever asked me what I think. I think that, as much as anything, points out the difference between what's happening between the old model of church and the new model of church that's emerging. The new model defines the church as the church of the people, of the poor, and they then become the subjects of it, that they understand and are actively involved in their faiths instead of passively receiving a doctrine and a faith from an ancient church hierarchy. Talk a little bit about the theological roots. I have to confess, I'm trying hard to develop the right brain in me and the creative side, but I still think very kind of orderly and logically, so I put things up in outline. So I hope it helps clarify and not obstruct your understanding of what we're talking about today. But the theological roots, on the one hand, they're difficult to see because they are underground in a sense. The theological roots are coming from a part of society that traditionally has not had access to the means of communication, to printed media, to centers of power. It's coming from the poor, both in the urban areas and in the rural areas, but it's very simple but very deep, profound theological roots. And as other people, such as priests and nuns and other lay people, are working with these people, these roots are emerging more and more, and we're gaining some access to them. But they essentially are based on a new experience of God. I wrote up here the theological idolatry, not atheism. And very interesting the way they pose the problems of faith, the question of faith now, in this new understanding of the church. I just read a quote that Pablo told me when I was talking to him once. He said, the problem for faith in Latin America comes not from atheists, but from those who do believe in God. Too many people in Latin America believe in God. Oppression in Latin America has come from those who believe in God. So the question that's emerging is the essential question in the church now is not do you believe in God, but which God do you believe in? Do you believe in a God that justifies and allows torture and oppression and keeping the vast majority of the people poor? Or do you believe in a God that is on the side of the poor, accompanying the poor in their struggles to liberate themselves and bring about a just society? So they're framing the question in a new way. And the Church of the Poor believes in a different understanding of God. And they base this, they would say, and I would agree with them, that this is a profoundly biblical experience. The one thing that, if anything, characterizes this emerging church is how deeply biblically based it is and how much I think it's difficult for us in North America and particularly for people who come from the Protestant tradition to understand how radically new the Bible is to Christians in Latin America. But they have had 450 years of never having access to the Bible, of being explicitly taught that the Bible was dangerous, they should not go near it. And the Bible was never available in Spanish or Portuguese. It was always available in Latin or some of the other European languages that they didn't have access to, particularly the Indian communities that didn't speak the language anyway. Now, in the last 20 years, they are coming with fresh eyes to the Bible and reading it for the first time, and they are basing their understanding on that. They start with the whole Exodus event, and they see God working in the Exodus event to take an oppressed people from Egypt, leading them through a wilderness experience into a promised land where they are promised liberation and the whole trials that accompany that. And they begin to reflect on this in light of their own situation of oppression. And they see a God that is not distant, not objective, not far off, but a God that is passionately involved in the struggles of people who are oppressed, so much so that this God chooses to send a son, God's only son, to live with these people and eventually die for these people. God cares so passionately, so involved with the people in their sufferings, that God accompanies them through thousands of years. And this is the understanding of God that is beginning to emerge for the Church of the Poor. There is a claim that they make. The claim is that God is especially present among the poor. And in order to discover what God is doing in this world, we must also be present with the poor. It's no longer the poor coming to the powerful and the wealthy to receive the doctrines, to see the faith. There's been a flip. There's a claim that God is especially active in working among the poor, and if we are concerned about knowing how God is acting today, that is where we will find the gospel being lived out, and that is where we'll find God. And this then it becomes one of the challenges of liberation theology, which tries to articulate the faith of these communities, to then justify if this God of the poor is the same God that Jesus Christ claimed and came and proclaimed. And I'll talk some more about that tomorrow when we look at liberation theology and how they begin to look at that. But again, I would emphasize that their first claim is that this is the biblical faith, that they are returning to a truer understanding of biblical faith. Very briefly on theological roots. Now let's look a little bit at the political roots. And part of this is just trying to understand the context, the social context that this theology is coming from. I've written up here just a few statistics that I'm going to refer to, but they give kind of the demographics. They set up some, in very cold analytical terms, some of the reality of what is happening throughout much of what we have called the third world, more accurately Asia, Africa, Latin America, and some other parts of the world. But in this century in particular, the turn of the century, there are about 1.6 billion people in the world. By 1980, this had gone up to 4 billion people, and by the turn of the next century, in about 15 years, we expect to have over 6 billion people in the world. So it would be a quadrupling of the population. But one of the most important things to realize about this is over 85% of this growth has taken place in the continents of Africa, Latin America, and Asia, with tremendous impact. In 1980, over 500 million people in the world lived in extreme poverty. This does not count the people who live merely in poverty, but extreme poverty, and they project by the year 2000 that 1.3 billion people will be living in extreme poverty. Nearly the entire population of the earth at the turn of the century, this 85 years ago. This then begins to set the context. Throughout the world, there are over 50 million people who die from poverty and hunger each year. And so this is when people are trying to understand what it means to believe in a God who cares, a God of justice. This is the context that they are dealing with. What the emerging church is beginning to, or is claiming, is that there is a system in power, a political, economic, social system, that for one reason or another has condemned the majority of the people to debilitating poverty. That as the growth has taken place, as the economic growth and development has taken place, more and more people find themselves impoverished and excluded from this system. And so they have begun to develop a new way of looking at this, a new perspective that they have called the logic of the majority, or viewing the situation from the underside. As Pablo Richards said, people in the church begin to look at the Bible and they see that the majority of the third world are those who were not invited to the banquet. This new perspective, or seeing the world through these eyes of the underside, the logic of the majority, has simply what it says, a new way of looking at things. The very first thing that it does, which is a radical step, is it recognizes that the poor exist. Most of the theology, of the political rhetoric, of the economic talk about development simply ignores the poor. It talks in other terms and other things that simply don't even acknowledge the fact that the poor exist. A good example of that, I think, would be the situation in Chile in the last 10 years since the overthrow of the Allende government. Chile has become kind of a model for the Chicago school of economics as a very, very free market approach to economics. And Chile has a population of about 12 million people. It has benefited 3 million of those people tremendously, and they've done very well, although lately it's shown some signs of disintegrating. But the other 9 million people have simply been excluded from that. They've been essentially irrelevant. The idea being that if you can get the economy going enough, eventually for the 3 million, eventually it will start to trickle down to the other 9 million. Well, this new perspective has begun to articulate what we might call a trickle-up theory. The idea that we need to structure our societies and our worlds to meet the basic needs first. And once those are met, then maybe some of the other things, the luxuries, can trickle up into society. It is a whole way of beginning to look at development from the point of view of the poor. When Jesus talks about good news to the poor, taking that whole framework and looking at how we develop economics and different systems, does it benefit the poor? I used an example yesterday that in the 60s, the emphasis on industrializing El Salvador, much of Central America, led to booming economies, very rapidly growing economies, but the cost to the poor was oftentimes very great. And so from 1960 to 1970, you went from 10 or 15% of El Salvador's population being landless to over 50% of the peasantry being landless. That was the cost of industrialization. And so while on the one hand the economy was booming, the question that needs to be asked after that is, who is that benefiting? And it did not benefit those who lost their land and their access to livelihood. So that's the new perspective then, thinking things through from the logic of the majority of the people rather than the minority. The other thing that they claim is that one of the charges that's often labeled against liberation theology or this kind of perspective is that it's political. And they are upfront in saying it is political, that there's no way that we can live our lives out as people of God and faithful and not have political overtones, because our life and our faith is taking place in this context, and that if we're going to be true to the gospel calling, that inevitably we'll have political overtones. The other thing is that Latin America is a profoundly religious continent. In many ways, there's a much closer interweaving of the whole cultural milieu and religion. It's not necessarily that you're going to find the whole population in church on Sunday. You won't. But that there is a deep infusion of the religious tradition, faith, among the people. And so that anything that is political or economic will also involve the religious aspects of the people. That's very briefly then the roots that are taking place in both theological and political for the new part or sector of the church. Talk a little bit about the Church of the Poor itself, and particularly how it's affecting different aspects there. In Central America, you find this church very strongly developed in a number of the countries such as Panama, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. And it is becoming about because of a new understanding of God. But the one thing, when you talk to them, very, very clear, because this is taking place amidst increasing polarization within the church. Remember yesterday we outlined three different trends within the church, and there has been a lot of struggle and conflict between these different understandings of who the church should be and what its nature should be. This new model, the church insists precisely on being that. They see themselves as a model, a new model, rather than a new church. They're emphatic that they belong within the church and are not a new church or a new sect that is seeking to separate itself. But in addition to claiming to be a new model, they also claim to be an old model. In fact, a far more ancient model of church than the church that's currently present there. And I've sketched out a couple different ways of understanding the church's relationship to society. What the Church of the Poor is claiming is that the dominant mode of church throughout Latin America in the centuries up to this point has been one of what's known as Christendom, which is Christendom is the model that as an alliance between the state and the church. And it dates back to the 4th century period with Constantine, when Christianity became the official religion for the first time of the Roman Empire. And apart from Constantine then, we saw various different alliances between the church and the state, or the church and economic powers. But it was a new model of the church, where the church now had access to power within the society, rather than being repressed by the powers, as it was in the first several centuries. What this tends to do then is that the state, or the centers of power, are the centers that mediate what gets down to the rest of society. And so things start at kind of an apex of the triangle and are mediated through the centers of power down to the lower levels of society. And the effect of this then is that you get a theology and a church that's dominated by the powerful, by the wealthy, by those who control society. Yesterday we talked about the alliance between the military, the oligarchy, and the church that has traditionally ruled much of Latin America. The Church of the Poor is seeking to return to a much older model of the church that was more prevalent in the early centuries of the church, which, in a sense, had the power of the church rest on the power of the gospel rather than the power of the state. It's a model that sees the church active through the gospel at the base levels of the society, and I've written here the poor or the base. And then it infuses these levels of the society and trusts in the power of the gospel to carry out the faith and the evangelization of the society. The new model stresses that the church needs to be built without relation to those in power. Now, one of the controversies then, or accusations made against this model, is that now the church has done just the opposite. The old church was one of the rich that excluded the poor. The new church now is one of the poor that excludes the rich. And the church is very emphatic in denying that. They say we do not exclude the wealthy from the church. But the church, the gospel, is being found in this context here. And if the wealthy are seeking the gospel, are seeking conversion, this is where they need to go. They aren't going to find it here. And remember again that they justify this biblically. They believe that the Bible has a profound bias in favor of the poor. And they point to such things as Jesus' first public address when he says, "I have come to preach good news to the poor." Or to the parable in Matthew 25, which talks about, "When did you do these to the least of my sisters and brothers, those who are in prison, those who are hungry, those who need to be clothed? When you did that to me." Jesus constantly mingling with the outsider in society and saying, those of you who want to enter into the kingdom need to become as little children, need to become as the poor, need the parable of the Good Samaritan. So the claim is that the gospel does not exclude the wealthy. But just like when Jesus says it's harder for the wealthy to enter the kingdom than through the eye of the needle, that they, in order for the wealthy to do this, they need to become with the poor and experience the gospel among the poor. This then leads into how the church is structuring itself at this model. And the primary building block of this has been what has been referred to as a number of different ways: base Christian communities, base ecclesial communities, base communities, the grassroots church. But these are essentially very small groups of 10 or 15 or 20 people who live in the same neighborhood in the margins of society, in the very poor areas, in the urban barrios or neighborhoods, in the countryside. They're people who get together and initially begin to reflect on their faith together. Oftentimes by reading the Bible for the first time. Oftentimes they get together and none of them know how to read, or only one of them may know how to read and write. And so one of the first things they begin to do is to teach each other to read and write. But in these small grassroots groups, sometimes they're affiliated with a priest, sometimes there's not a priest within miles, and so they have a lay delegate or a member guiding them. They begin to reflect on a couple things, both the biblical story and how it impacts on their own lives, and then the situation they find themselves in. And they read hand in hand the story that's presented in the Bible and their own situation. So an example might be reading the words of Jesus, "I have come that you have life and that you have it abundantly." Well, it doesn't take much imagination for them to look around in their neighborhood and see no sewers, and see alcoholism running at 50%, and see no access to drinking water. All these kinds of things, and say, what does this mean to us? We have nothing that evidences abundant life here. And it's much less easy for them to spiritualize those words, to think that, well, I have abundant life in my heart, because their life there is anything but abundant. But slowly, it's a very, very slow process, much like the leavening of flour. These conversations take place, and they begin to reflect on them and the stories in light of their own life, and begin to work together then to change some of the situation. And it may begin with a very simple thing, such as after they've learned to read, they begin to realize that they have a legal right to potable water in the neighborhood. And so they may organize and go to the Ministry of Water and demand that there be water brought into the neighborhood. For these people, this is a radical step, and it may take place after several years of reflecting together. But they begin to move and to challenge their own situation. Oftentimes, it's very interesting to talk with people in the base communities as they reflect about their own stories, because they reflect back on some of their own naivete. Many times they'll get together and they'll say, hey, we have a right to clean water. Let's go and demand our right to that. And so they will go as a group to demand that, and they may experience being beaten by the police. They may experience having the police come into their neighborhood and harassing them, or kidnapping some of their people. All these kinds of the repression that comes from when they begin to challenge the state here. And their immediate response was one of surprise oftentimes. They sort of thought that for the first time realized they had these rights, formal rights, and yet when they try to claim them, they are oftentimes repressed. And this then leads to a deepening of their understanding of the faith. And there is a whole ongoing process of reflection, action, reflection, action, going on and on and on. They will read together to study the Bible, see what it means for their faith. They will act on that. They will experience what happens to them, deepen their reflection. And the whole movement continues on in this manner. What has happened, however, is this loose network of different grassroots communities has essentially exploded in much of Latin America. In Brazil, for example, there are tens of thousands of these grassroots communities throughout the country. In El Salvador, these were the prime motivator in many ways behind the attempt for reform and political social change that took place in the late 70s there, that has resulted in the civil war and the repression that's taken place. But they take place out of a very simple but deep understanding of God as a God who accompanies the people in bringing life to them. So they've oftentimes talked about this as the option for life. Or liberation theology is oftentimes being called now a theology for life. Because it's a theology, if you remember the refrain that we sang last night, it has very deep meaning for them. It says, peace, we want peace and liberty in this world. Not excluding it in the next world, but they want it also in this world. And they believe that the gospel promises that to them as well. Probably the most dramatic thing about this understanding of the church is that the poor now see themselves as the subjects of the gospel, as active participants in that.
As I listen to you, you're talking about the Church of the Poor having arrived at some philosophical understanding of this. Now, how many of the poor are involved in this philosophical understanding, the poor themselves? Mm-hmm. When you talk about a group that only one can read the Bible, possibly, and their understanding of the Exodus. Well, it's going to take, in a community where you have only one person read the Bible, and it has to be done orally, and how long is it going to take them before they get through Exodus and get through the New Testament and get through any things mm-hmm. as a basis for a philosophical understanding?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question, and there are a couple things I encourage. One, many of us don't have the opportunity to actually participate in a base community meeting, so the best we can do oftentimes is to get a more second-hand approach. But I'd encourage you to read through, for example, just some chapters in the Gospel of Solentiname, which just record the conversations, because I think you'd be surprised sometimes at the level of sophistication. But again, the danger is to romanticize this thing and to think the poor are extremely wise or the only wise people, so forth. It's a mixed bag, and it's a long process. But it is a church that's taking place primarily among the poor. Now, when I talk about liberation theology, there are very academically educated people involved in this movement as well. And liberation theology, liberation theologians within the church are oftentimes those who try and take the insights that are coming out of this movement and articulate them in theological language. And so some of what I'm sharing with you that may sound philosophical or theological is simply the insights that are emerging from these communities and being articulated in a way that they have access to a different community, such as a theological community. But that's not to deny, however, some of the sophistication you come across in some of these communities. And one example that just, I was with a group of North Americans, we were in Nicaragua, and we were visiting a base community way out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, they were way out in the rural part of the country. And we got there, and we shared, they shared the Bible reading with us, we began to talk, and then one of them pulled out a newspaper and said, "This is the text of the speech that your president, President Reagan, gave 3 days ago. We've been analyzing it for the last 3 days, but we'd like to know what your thoughts are on it first." And none of us in the group even realized he had given a speech. But it was an example. They take very seriously the world that's going around them. And then we talked about that. And the kind of sophistication and the way they talked about that speech, I think, kind of blew the rest of us away. We had one image of what the poor are like and the poor's ability to think for themselves. And this was a community that had been going for 5 or 6 years, so they had reached a level of maturity. You'll find other communities that are just beginning, and the big challenge is getting the people to talk. Very much like the situation of the elderly man I said in the story, they have never been given the opportunity to talk. And I remember another time we were meeting with a group in Mexico, and we were sitting there talking, and there was a lot of silence, and finally one of the women looked up, and she was kind of emotional. She started to cry, and she said, "You have to understand how difficult this is for us. We have learned that when we speak up, we are put down." And it was a whole challenge just for them to begin to talk to each other. In other areas of Latin America, it's a tremendous challenge because the whole ethic of machismo is very powerful. And oftentimes the most powerful agents within these communities are the women. My experience by far and away is that the women oftentimes are far more radical and far more progressive. But they oftentimes are forbidden by their husbands to take place in these, or forbidden to learn to read. And so they have a whole other dynamic taking place. But it's a process that takes place at various different levels. I'll just go briefly over some of the identity and mission that they see for themselves, and then we can come back or just take more time for some questions and flesh out more of these. Let me just mention some of the important characteristics of the base communities. One is one of the most important is that they are born at the base themselves, and the leaders in these communities are members of the communities themselves. They're not foreign agents who have been educated elsewhere that come in. If anything, it's oftentimes a member of the community that has gone from there to study for a while with a priest or a lay catechist course and then has come back. But part of their success is that they take place among the people themselves, among people that they know and trust. And so they're born at the base rather than imposed from above. A second very important characteristic is that they are based on solidarity among the people. There is very much a class consciousness of them being the poor and the marginalized, and they're based on solidarity and a non-hierarchical structure. One that emphasizes more of a circle kind of structure and everybody participating. And we had this driven home for us another time when they were there when we wanted to sing a song, and we were rather embarrassed because we didn't know how to sing Spanish very well, and And they just simply said to us, they said, listen, if we let that stop us, we'd get nowhere. Everybody participates. And so you'll see that when they read the Bible story, they will literally pass the Bible around and have everybody have a chance to contribute something. So a non-hierarchical structure. In many areas where the base communities have flourished, it has been where they have had some institutional support from the church hierarchy. Good example, again, is Brazil, where many of the Brazilian bishops have aligned themselves very solidly with this movement and have supported it. In other countries where the bishops are very much opposed to this and where there's repressive government in place, the base communities have not gotten started. And so there's oftentimes been a relationship with some support from the hierarchy, and then the communities have flourished. And lastly, I mentioned again that the biblical reflection is the thing that characterizes the methodology of the communities. The Bible is always central to what they're doing, but always combined with the context of the reality that they're living out daily. Just mentioned a few things about their identity and mission there. Just have written down a note for myself that I'll read here, that they see that the starting point is one of a church that is immersed in the reality of the poor, becomes identified with the world of the poor who participate and then take power within the church. As far as a prophetic identity, they understand the prophet is the one who can discern and announce the will of God. And this is something they take very seriously, of discerning within their societies what is the will of God. They see the Bible as giving the criteria for us involved in today's world, discerning and living out that will. They look to the Bible to see how God acted in times of past with God's people in liberating them from situations of suffering and oppression, or in rebuking them when they in turn became the oppressors of other people, and they use that criteria for discerning how to live in their own situation. The messianic identity is they see themselves as a community that announces the reign of God or the kingdom of God in our midst, never identifying any particular political project with the kingdom, but seeing the kingdom breaking in amidst them. For example, many people we've talked to, and it's very interesting how the symbol of Nicaragua has for many of these poor become a beacon of hope. One of the things that took place early in Nicaragua was the whole agrarian reform. And when you talk to campesinos whose life is built around the land and yet have been denied access to the land for hundreds of years, and then they see in a country like Nicaragua land being returned to the people of the land, the poor, the peasantry, they see this as a sign of the kingdom being built in their midst. Not identifying the kingdom necessarily with the political program of the Sandinistas, but the idea of land being given back to the people is a sign that the kingdom of God is there and that we can participate in that. And so they see themselves as discerning and announcing the kingdom of God in our midst. And finally, in their pastoral dimension, the word, I think it was one of the early people to enunciate this was Archbishop Romero, the former Archbishop of El Salvador, who saw his pastoral task as being one of accompaniment. He saw himself not as bringing the gospel to the poor or bringing it and giving it to them, but rather accompanying the poor as they discovered the gospel within their midst, as the word of God took place within their midst. The role of the church as a spiritual or pastoral role was one of accompaniment of the people through their trials, through their suffering, through their joys, through their triumphs, but walking side by side with them as their pastoral mission. It's interesting in terms of how, just a footnote here, how then the church is beginning to look at something like the ecumenical, the quote ecumenical problem. It has really reframed the whole question of ecumenics, so the whole question of different churches. And what we were talking with some of the members of the theological community there, and they said the ecumenical problem in Latin America is not that we are divided into several confessions. They said, actually, that's quite good, because each one of the different confessions, whether it's Lutheran or Presbyterian or Roman Catholic, has something for us to contribute something to us in understanding our walk with God. That's not the problem, that we have a number of confessions. The problem is that we compete with other confessions to conquer other confessions, to add to our own church power, to our own ecclesiastical power. And so it becomes a numbers game or a competition to see who has the most and who has the power, when in fact we should celebrate the diversity of confessions that, that help us understand this. But ecumenism here now breaks through many of the doctrinal things because it simply becomes those who are working together to discern the will of God in working with the poor. And when I talk about the church in El Salvador, I think that's one place where I have seen that so much, because you have churches there that the Salvadoran or the Lutheran church began as a Missouri Synod church, not one that's especially noted for its ecumenical fervor in this country. The Baptist church there began as a Southern Baptist church. The Roman Catholic church was a very conservative, traditional church. And yet these churches now, being confronted by the war there and having to choose how to respond to the poor and the refugees, are working together beautifully. And they have essentially put aside their doctrinal differences, learned where they can work together, and have built a whole new spirit of ecumenism, built not on doctrinal agreement, but on working together to carry out the will of God in their context. I think I'll stop or pause right there, and then if people have questions now, we can take some.
I heard a tape you're holding about Somoza inviting Protestants into Nicaragua before the fall in order to disrupt the unity of the Catholic Church and hopefully to add power to divide them, anyway, in terms of giving more support to Somoza and his regime. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of interesting. Does that fit into your pattern in a sense? Is there any? Did any of these Protestant denominations start that way with invitations?
Well, it's the Protestant history in Latin America is fascinating, and I'm certainly not an expert on it all, although I studied in a Protestant seminary in Costa Rica, so I met many of the different people from these. Be careful, too, because yesterday, at the very tail end of the conversation, someone asked me a question about the Protestant influence, and I made a very gross oversimplification about fundamentalists and some of the negative impact. So I will preface my comments with saying that there are many exceptions to what I'll say and a lot of diversity. We're talking about a continent that's got 450 million people, so it's obviously this is not going to cover everything. But there are two waves of Protestantism that as I understand, have taken place in Latin America. Toward the end of the 1800s and the early part of this century, what we know as the historical churches, the Lutherans, Presbyterians, Methodists, many of them sent missionaries. There was a great emphasis in the mid-1800s, late 1800s, to send missionaries to start churches in these countries. And certainly in the southern cone of South America, you see the Lutheran church present there and European influence. By and large, those churches remain fairly small churches, and they are over 100 years old. They have some roots, but they, except for a few areas, did not grow very large. And what has happened in the last 20 years has been a tremendous increase among the Pentecostal and the fundamentalist churches. Usually from with North American roots, usually from the Bible Belt, and a lot of money coming in behind them. So, for example, in Guatemala, you had a situation where you now have more Pentecostal preachers in Guatemala than you have Catholic priests, because there's just a tremendous emphasis on that kind of evangelization. Oftentimes, because these fundamentalist religions in particular come with a very strongly anti-communist ideology or component to their preaching, they are welcomed by those in power, particularly when these are military dictatorships and there's a very close relationship. They're given full access to the society. They're allowed to preach in the parks and a number of different things. And there have been a number of cases where there have been campaigns. I was giving an example yesterday of a case I know of in El Salvador where there was a whole organizing campaign. It said something like, organizing is the answer. Their slogan was that where they were working for getting a better wage. And coincidentally, at the same time, this whole, with the cooperation of the government, this whole evangelical campaign came along whose slogan was, Christ is the only answer. And so there have been this manipulation of the faith, oftentimes in the fundamentalists, split the different groups. The two most rapidly growing trends within the church in Latin America are the base community movement that I mentioned here and the Pentecostal movement. And they both tend to take place among the poor. The Pentecostal movement tends to be a much more spiritualized approach. The base community movement tends to be much more focused on the reality of the world around them. But they're both growing very rapidly, and there is a lot of tension between them oftentimes within any particular community.
Could you just talk a little more about that? I'm trying to get a sense of, is the base Christian community primarily Catholic people, and would there be in the same neighborhood a Pentecostal group meeting in another house, mm-hmm. and wouldn't they be studying scriptures too in a way somewhat similar? And where would, if there happened to be a Protestant mainliner in that neighborhood, where would they fit in all that? Mm-hmm.
This is true particularly in the cities. In the rural areas, you still primarily see a Catholic church in town that's the primary thing. But in the cities, you find a wealth of different churches. And you find one of the reasons I think the Pentecostal churches have been so successful, and same way they have oftentimes in the North American context, you see the equivalent of our storefront church. And you have Pentecostal pastors who are very, very devoted to the people and live, they go in, they work with the poor, they are right there in the midst of them. They have a very, very humble church. They spend all their time talking with people. And so you'll go in and you will find Pentecostal church on the corner. You may find that the base community is moving there. You'll find the traditional church. In the more middle-class neighborhoods, you'll tend to find the historical churches such as the Lutheran or the Methodist. Not so much among the poor, although that's changing somewhat. Now, as far as the base community movement, it has essentially been a Catholic movement, although in places where the Protestant churches are starting to suffer repression, there has been development of equivalent kinds of things as the base communities. And El Salvador is a very good example of that. Up until 5 or 6 years ago, the Protestant churches were essentially exempt from the kind of repression that was being leveled against the Catholic Church for the Catholic Church's work among the poor. I'll be showing a video on the Lutheran Church in El Salvador later on, and it talks about how their change, when they begin to work with the displaced and the poor, how they in turn suffered the repression, and they begin to go through the same kind of cycle of reflection and action that we see developing in the base communities, of them deepening their roots. As a result, there is a lot of cooperation and sharing now between the Protestant churches and the Catholic churches there, each maintaining their own integrity, but working closely together. And so while the base communities per se have not developed the same way within Protestant churches, many of the dynamics and reflection have. And so Medardo Gomez, the pastor of the Salvadoran church now, says that all theology, if it's Christian, must be liberation theology, because theology is about God liberating God's people. That's quite a move from traditional Missouri Synod Lutheran theology, and it's come because of the repression they've suffered.
Please. Is the Pentecostal church as concerned with the people and their economic well and getting them out into this community?
My experience is not as direct, and it happens in place. I've had experience with the Pentecostal church in Costa Rica, where it's fairly strong, and in Puerto Rico, where it's very strong, and I know some people from Chile, where it's also very strong. The Pentecostal church tends to focus on what it considers the moral aspects. And if there are others of you who have more experience with this, please feel free to correct me if I'm putting this out of it. But my understanding and experience I've had is it draws a sharp distinction, for example, between Catholics and Pentecostals over the question of smoking, question of drinking. Many of the things that come out of our more traditional pietistic faiths in this country, you'll see there as well. Now, in some places, in Chile, for example, there have been sectors of the Pentecostal church which have developed as resistance to the Pinochet regime, because one of the things about these churches, as you were saying, they are strongly biblical churches, and so they know their Bibles well. And while oftentimes the interpretation they give is a more spiritualized interpretation, there are occasions when they just see that something is clearly wrong, and therefore they take a stance out of their biblical stance and have developed more into resistance. But generally, it's been less on the social aspects and more on the individual moral aspects.
Brazil is very strong in terms of the Pentecostal church too. And one thing that's very different between state and church, they are very, the Roman 13, it's very clear to them. You don't the church needs to deal with the soul of the people and not get involved in any kind of social problem. And as Chile is a little bit different because the situation is so drastic that he needed to take a stand. But so they try to focus only on the individual, the soul, and the social problems. You know, you need to endure it here, and then in afterlife, if you have a better life.
And that's thank you for that, because that also is one of the distinctions between the Church of the Poor and, say, the Pentecostal community. Church of the Poor does not see itself as being a political power in the sense of the old model. And it doesn't see itself as being apolitical. It sees itself as being on the side of the poor. But it does. The difference is that the church exists on the benefit. Well, I forgot to mention there. One of the things that flushes out the difference between the two different models of the church are the kinds of questions they ask. And the older model tends to be a question that always asking what is important for the church. You can see this particularly in the Vatican. The Vatican has ambassadors to different countries that essentially are there to protect the interests of the church. And it's interested in protecting institutional integrity, the doctrine, and so forth. The questions it asks are what are important for the church. The new this model of the Church of the Poor is trying to ask questions of what are important to the people, and how, and what are the interests of the people, and how are we involved in promoting and protecting those interests. And so it's not apolitical. It has a political interest on behalf of the poor, but it at least claims to try not to use that influence to advance its own interests, but rather the interests of the people. And one of the very interesting places to watch right now is Nicaragua, because it's one of the few places in Latin America where this Church of the Poor is seen not as a threat to the government, but as a support to the kinds of things that the government is trying to carry out, such as education, literacy, and healthcare, so forth. Whereas the traditional church in Nicaragua, which has operated traditionally under this kind of model, is very much in tension with the government. And the question that or a lot of people are looking at the church in Nicaragua, because the temptation for this church is to move from this model into a new form of this model. They now exist in a society where the government is on their side, and so it's very tempting for the Church of the Poor, for the base communities, to form an alliance with the Sandinista government in order to carry out their interests. And yet their model is still working with the powerless, with the poor, at the base, and empowering those people then to go out and make the change, and not form that alliance. And many people, you know, this is where the debate oftentimes centers in Nicaragua. Has this become a new form of Christendom where the base communities now are simply in alliance with the Sandinistas, or are they in fact continuing to work among the poor, empowering them to make changes for themselves?
Yeah. This is where an awful lot of confusion is coming for us, trying to figure out what's accurate if we rely on media. The other day, the paper was just full of stories about the persecution of the church by the Sandinista government. But it's that form of the church, not
this
the Church of the Poor.
Right.
And so many people don't realize that, understand the distinction.
Well, and it's very interesting. I think it was Jody was saying that he might do something on how the media reports later on. But it's very interesting to see what gets picked up. Many people are familiar, for example, there's a lot of tension right now between the church hierarchy and the Sandinista government, and a very, very bitter battle going on. And many people are familiar, for example, that a month ago, the Sandinistas expelled one of the bishops from Nicaragua. That got a lot of attention in our paper and was seen as evidence of the persecution of the church. I would say much fewer people are aware of the hundreds of lay leaders in the church there involved in this model, the base communities, who have been killed by the Contras. The delegates of the word that go out and begin these communities are among the people who are specifically targeted by the Contras, because they see them as leaders within the grassroots communities that are a threat to returning to this kind of system. And so I personally have known several who have been killed, and brutally so. But that is not used as evidence of persecution of the church among the Contras, whereas expelling the bishop is. And that's not to justify the expelling of the bishop, but it's to see that there is no such thing as a uniform monolithic church that exists there. There are many different tendencies, and if we don't understand the tendencies, it's harder to understand the kinds of conflicts that are going on. So the tension that is developing between, quote, the church and, quote, the government in Nicaragua is more, I would say more accurately, between one strain in the church, the more traditional hierarchical church, and the government. Whereas when I was there 3 weeks ago, we participated, they had the third annual meeting of base communities in the city of Matagalpa. And it was a very moving event because there were over 10,000 Christians involved in these base communities who came from all over Nicaragua, and very poor Nicaraguans. And many of them had traveled through the war zones, risking their lives to get there. And they came there to celebrate a mass together, to essentially say that we are in support of the kind of revolution that's being carried out here. Again, I don't remember any of that being reported in the media up here, so you wouldn't have no idea that there was that kind of sector of the church that was in favor. But there's that is going on there. You go here and then here.
I don't know if you want to talk about this or not, or translating that into economic systems. You can see where there are problems immediately with capitalism once you have that basis. Does that mean Marxism, or does that mean something new, or does it mean that that can impact any economic system?
A couple things. I think I will dodge the Marxism issue somewhat today so I can focus on it more when I've had a chance to set up a context for it. On the other hand, people involved in this are very explicit that they are not constructing any one particular social economic system. This is a theology that will inform and critique any system within it. There are some systems that they believe are closer to what God is proclaiming in the kingdom. And they would, when I talked about this logic of the majority, that becomes one of their criteria. Is it an economic and political system that begins by asking how does this benefit the poor, rather than ends by saying if this happens something may trickle down? And so in that sense, they really believe that they have experienced the underside of international capitalism. International capitalism has served tremendously to enrich in many of the Northern Atlantic countries of Europe and North America. But they believe that the flip side of that has been the impoverishment. So they tend to be very critical of capitalism. As far as Marxism, I'll talk a little bit more about the difference between Marxism as a philosophy and Marxism as a sociological tool to understand things. And they are very much not in favor of Marxism as a philosophy that predicts where the world is going in terms of the stages of capitalism, socialism, communism. But they have found some insights in Marxism that help them understand the economic dynamics that then they use to critique that. But I'll try and talk about that a little bit more tomorrow and talk about liberation theology. You had a question?
Just a question about terminology. An individual who is part of a Christian-based community, I am part of, and would that be finished by a Spanish translation of Christian-based community?
The comunidad de base is comunidad ecclesial de base, which is base ecclesial community. One of the reasons there's a number of different terminologies that originally were known as base Christian communities, but the church hierarchy in the Vatican became very concerned that did not emphasize the church affiliation, that this was somehow, it might be interpreted as a separatist movement. And so they begin to take the term base ecclesial communities to talk about them being communities that took place at the base level of the ecclesia, of the church. And that's another thing that's very important. Most of these exist within a parish. The difference is that parishes in Latin America oftentimes have several thousand people, and so you may have many different base communities within a parish. But for example, the communities that I have a relationship with in El Salvador are from the parishes of San Antonio or the parishes of Esperanza. They're parishes with a priest and nuns and so forth, but they're base communities that take place within them. Oftentimes where they have a close relationship with the parish, the priests or the nuns are very much supportive of what they're doing. There are other cases where there have been sort of base communities in exile where they are part of a parish, but the priest does not support them or the bishop does not support them, and so they had to go outside the parish to be able to meet together.
Seems that Pope John is having the same problem in dealing with the liberation theology. he does come down on it, but not too hard.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see. I think the Pope is in a very uncomfortable position, because on the one hand he's very, very leery of Marxism and how that might influence the church, and so there are many parts of liberation theology that concern him. On the other hand, he has come out time and again with a stated commitment of the church to the poor, and the church being on the side of the poor, and so he can't very well oppose the fact that the people in the church are getting involved in the church. What he has opposed is his fear of them being manipulated by Marxism. And so he's come out, stated his support of the base communities, his support for the church being, the poor being involved in the church. But he is also has a very strongly vested interest in restoring the hierarchical nature of the Catholic Church, and particularly obedience to the Vatican and to the magisterium, the teaching there. So that this model of the church is what is so threatening to him, because it exists from this perspective rather than a top-down perspective. It's very interesting to see, I don't know if any of you have followed the case of Father Leonardo Boff, a Franciscan Brazilian priest who was censored for a year by the Vatican until recently this was lifted. But he had a variety of different teachings that the Vatican considered dangerous. But the book that they really focused on was when he took the insights from this model of church and began to question the Vatican's authority over, in a hierarchical sense, over Christians involved in this. And so it was when the Vatican began to feel its own authority being challenged that they clamped down on that. And that, I think, is where Pope John Paul is very concerned. Not the fact that the poor, good things are happening with the poor, but the fact that this model may in fact challenge a top-down model that the Vatican is built on. Now that's where it's very interesting, and Germano could probably tell us more, but to watch the relationship between the Brazilian bishops and the Vatican is very, very interesting, because the Brazilian bishops by and large have supported this newer model and are very strongly defending it, and they've been called to Rome and reprimanded, and there's been a whole kind of debate going on. But the church, the Vatican is being very, very concerned, because they don't want to lose the third world. By the end of the century, the majority of Christians will be in the so-called mission field. They'll be in Latin America, they'll be in Africa, and a few places in Asia. And the largest Christian church in the world right now is the Brazilian Catholic Church. And so the Vatican has to be very careful that it does not alienate. The way in the 19th century the Vatican lost much of the working class when it could not understand the Industrial Revolution, how that was affecting workers, wants to be careful that it doesn't alienate much of the Latin American church as well. There's quite a hand over here. Kim?
Yeah, if you could talk a little bit more about sort of the actions that the base communities take.
Okay, yeah. Let me just mention again, this is a simplification, because there's a lot of diversity in how this takes place, but kind of a schematic understanding of how a base community might start. I know a number of people in Cuernavaca, Mexico, who are known as promoters of the word, who are people who have invested their life out in taking the word into poor. They are poor themselves, and they go into other poor neighborhoods and essentially preach and plant the seeds for new communities. And the kind of process that develops is they will go into a poor neighborhood and just start meeting the people there and talking with them. And then they will invite them to a meeting sometime. And they may get two or three, they may get four or five people who show up. And they say, we're going to get together, we're going to sing some songs, we're going to read the Bible. And for the first few weeks, that's what they'll do, is have the people introduce themselves, tell their names, and then simply sing some songs together and to read a few of the Bible stories. Until the people begin being a little more comfortable with this. And then they will begin to do some very, very simple or reflection on the Bible, just talking about what the Bible meant in Jesus' time and how those people related to the Bible, what the Bible stories meant. And they'll begin to ask for some feedback on that. Eventually, at some point, the people will begin to see, someone will mention, well, that was the way it was in Jesus' time, and that reminds me of the way it is here. Or you know, when we talk about spending all day in the marketplace and not selling my wares, that reminds me of last week when I had my oranges, but I couldn't sell them, and therefore I didn't have any tortillas to give to my kids. They begin to draw the parallels between their life, and they begin to reflect on that. Then they'll move into some of the stories of the gospel that talk about where early Christians did come into conflict because of their beliefs with things that were promised from the kingdom versus the reality of, say, the tax system of Rome. And they'll begin to reflect on their own situation. They may then, oftentimes the first, they'll begin to talk about what are the causes of the situation. For example, what are the causes of the alcoholism that's in their neighborhood? And they may say, well, the causes are the fact that there's liquor available and my husband goes out and spends my wages on that. So at the initial stage, they'll see that as the cause. And they'll begin to talk about how they can approach alcoholism. Well, maybe we can educate our husbands, or maybe we can close down the liquor store or something. As they go along, though, they may begin to deepen that and begin to realize, well, my husband or my son are drinking because they don't have a job. They don't have anything else to do. They get depressed. And so they go for and they get depressed, and they go out, and they try and relieve that by getting drunk. And then they begin to ask questions, why don't they have a job? Why is it that all the young men in the neighborhood here don't have a job? Why is the unemployment like this? And so slowly over time, they begin to deepen the model, and then they'll begin to look at the economic system. Why is it that 50% of our people can't get work? Until they'll begin to, you'll find people, it's astonishing for me as a middle-class North American to go into a very poor neighborhood and hear and see these Christians reading the policies of the International Monetary Fund and what that means for Mexico. And they will say, if the IMF gives this loan to Mexico, then Mexico has to cut down the spending on education, has to cut down the spending on health care. We already don't have enough schools. What happened the last time the loan came through? We lost this and this and this. So maybe it does affect the economy and the wealthy, but we lost as poor people. So you begin to see at all levels this kind of deepening of reflection, so that the initial causes of, say, alcoholism, which they might have seen as the liquor store on the corner, now they begin to see that maybe there are other reasons why there's social problems, or the fact that there are health problems, all the children are sick. And so they begin to deepen this. This then leads them oftentimes to organizing themselves. And this, the case that I'm most familiar with is the situation in El Salvador, where as I mentioned, in the 60s, what was happening in El Salvador as it began to try and advance its economy or industrialize it, was that vast numbers of people were pushed off the land. This created a labor pool that they needed to have the new industry taking place there, but it also brought about vast impoverishment of the people.